In the 129th Block Talks, we speak with Neeraj Kashyap, founder of Moonstream, who tells us how fun Web3 games can be. I'm your host, Mauricio Magaldi, and this is Block Drops, your weekly digest on blockchain for business.
These news are not a form of endorsement, sponsorship, or encouragement for consumption, and are meant for educational purposes only.
All right, everybody. I'm here with Neeraj Kashyap from Moonstream, who's going to tell us who he is and what he does with blockchain. Neeraj, welcome to Block Talks.
Thank you, Mauricio. My name is Neeraj. I'm the founder of Moonstream, and we're all about blockchain gaming. Specifically, we build on-chain games, and even more specifically, we build permissionless games. We also build all of the infrastructure required in order to make these games work and make these games easy to play. And we, you know, our product, we have an infrastructure product that other games use in order to run their games, their Web3 games as well. So that's in a package. What we do is that we build games. We're really sort of at the cutting edge of, like, you know, what games in this space look like. And all of the tooling, all of the infrastructure that we create in order to make our games, we sell that to other games as well. And that helps them to be successful as well.
I love games, man. And I have such high hopes that games are the onboarding mechanism of most people into Web3. But the previous generation of games, the so-called play-to-earn games that had a big boom during the lockdown, during the pandemic, they kind of fizzled out afterwards because they didn't have this lasting mechanic for it to be sustainably successful. Before you had this idea, what is the difference between what you guys are building, and how do you see the previous generation of Web3 games compared to this one?
Well, I will say one thing, you know, I think it's too early to call it the previous generation of Web3 games. Axie Infinity is not dead, right? And Pixels launched on Ronin, like, it's popping off. Like, you know, basically they have too much money to die quietly. And I think it was pretty easy to say in the bear market that you know, their economic model was bad, or, like, you know, the game sort of had died. But it's not so easy to kill off a movement.
By no means I'm declaring the death of the previous generation, but they are previously started. There was a different, you know, macro scenario. There were different even primitives from the chains to play with, and we've seen a lot of evolution both in standards, in scalability, in the, I want to say, the fractal nature of now L2s, L3s, app chains, supernets, and all the jazz that obviously were not present in the early wave of or the earlier wave or the previous wave of. So I'm not killing any of the previous games, although some did die, but I'm just trying to kind of capture the thinking about how we're thinking about Web3 games now as compared to the previous generation.
Okay, yeah, sure. And it's actually a very good question. I just wanted to clarify about, like, you know, I used to think that way. I used to think that play to earn was dead, but now I've sort of changed my thinking after seeing what's happening. Like, I think the Sky Mavis guys are actually quite brilliant, even though I don't agree, you know, I don't particularly build games like that, but I think their playbook was good. But I can tell you sort of, you know, how we're approaching this. So just from first principles, you know, the question that I care about, like, the question that I cared about certainly when we started, and I still care about now, is what kind of games can we build with Web3 that we couldn't build without Web3, right? And I think this is kind of the point that you're making, is, like, a lot of those games, they didn't really need Web3, right? Like, Web3 sort of helped them capture the hype, it helped them capture excitement, it gave them, like, sort of a captive user base who could, like, you know, put their entire life savings and even more into, like, you know, into assets, and then they sort of had to have the game be successful. But for most of those things, it was just a fancy form of crowdfunding. And, you know, it was a little bit better than Kickstarter because there was just so much hype around crypto in 2021, or, you know, that kind of stuff. So I'm talking about something more essential. You know, the thing that I care about is, what kind of games does Web3 allow us to build that couldn't have been built without Web3? And for me, the answer is actually pretty clear. So if you think about chess, I like to make an analogy with chess. Okay, do you play chess, Mauricio?
I'm bad at it, but I like it, yes.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I mean, you sort of get it, right? So, chess is fundamentally a permissionless game, right? You and I, if both of us understood chess notation and understood the rules of chess, we could play by just telling our moves to each other, right? I could say e4, you could say e5, right? And we could sort of play an entire game as with each other just by communicating, verbally or by communicating in written form or whatever, right? Even if we didn't speak the same language. So that's amazing about chess, right? But if we wanted to play chess with each other digitally, like on a computer or online, that's not permissionless, right? We would be subject to the rules of chess.com or Lee Chess or Yahoo Chess or any website that actually implemented the game client, right? And there's all kinds of problems with that. Like chess.com frequently bans people for cheating, and it might be unfair, right? There's just all kinds of issues. Their infrastructure might go down. There's all of this stuff, all of this baggage that comes with the fact that all of the digital clients to chess have to be run by private organizations. So the great thing about blockchains and Web3 is that that's a technology that for the first time in history allows us to create digital permissionless games. So permissionless game, like digital games that don't require us to trust some central server in order to run the game. So for me, that's the most important thing that this technology enables, and we design games that take advantage of that. So we build permissionless games in which nobody has any privileged status with respect to the rules of the game. We publish the rules of the game on the blockchain, and then we have different ways of making money. Chess is a permissionless game. Chess.com is a $100 million a year business because they have a really great digital client to chess, right? That's the way that we monetize our involvement with the games, is that we provide really great clients to the game, but fundamentally, the games that we build are permissionless, and anybody can play with them on whatever blockchains they live on, without any restrictions whatsoever. Those are the kinds of games that we build.
I love the fact that permissionlessness brings the best and also the worst in people, because if you think about the wider crypto market, permissionless is what enabled some of the higher scandals, I would say, about all of that, but also the wild innovation we're seeing in many fronts. Now, one thing to kind of explore is, I love the thinking, but there's something that triggered that thinking in you when you came up with the idea, like back when. Like, what was the process of reaching that epiphany of like, ah, this is what we should be about, and not the other thousand things that were possible? And how did your previous experience, professional experience, or life experience played towards that decision or that epiphany?
Actually, we had one very clear catalyzing moment. So when we started out, we started Moonstream in summer of 2021, like late spring of 2021, and we were an analytics company, right? So basically, if you were deploying a smart contract onto an EVM blockchain, an EVM blockchain, it was like Google Analytics, right? You could come to Moonstream, you could set up a subscription. I want to know how people are using this smart contract, and then you could pull that data. And we had two traction amongst two groups of customers at the time. We had just crypto traders, people who are trying to trade on DEXs and stuff like that. And then we had game developers. And I very much like the game developers more than I like the crypto traders, just as a base of customers. They were more loyal. They didn't just view us as as a commodity, and they were willing to engage with us and give us feedback and tell us how to improve our product, right? So I just liked game developers, and we decided, okay, we're just going to focus on this. The first customer that we had that got big, it's a game called Crypto Unicorns on Polygon. It's one of the largest games on the Polygon blockchain. And we were pretty critical to their success in early on. So they launched their NFTs in November of 2021, and it sort of made me think, it made me realize that the value of Moonstream wasn't just to tell them what was going on with their game contracts. It was, first of all, for them, it wasn't just contracts, right? That was their economy. They were using Moonstream to figure out what was going on inside their economy. And the part that was missing for them was feeding back, right? So once they know what's going on in their economy, they want to have some influence over how players are acting. They want to give them incentives, right? They wanted to act basically as a central bank to their game economy. and they didn't have the means to do so. And so that really shaped our product, because it made me realize that it wasn't just about providing them with analytics. It was also about giving them ways to feed back into their economy. And so I was experimenting with like a bunch of such mechanisms. And I remember, I still remember, it was like Christmas Eve 2021. Sort of, they reached out to me and they're like, "Hey, so, you know, we did this thing. We're supposed to launch in February, but that's probably not going to happen. You know, what can we do, right? Do you have anything that, like, you know, we can use to sort of like fill in that space?" And I'd been experimenting with these mechanisms. I was like, "All right." So what I pitched them was like this on-chain game. It was a game where, you know, their characters could go out and do an exploration. So their characters are crypto unicorns. They could go out and explore the dark forest. They would come back with, like, you know, some sort of resources, and then they could like basically sacrifice those resources for a chance at getting like something cool, right? That was the rough thing that I pitched them. They sort of took it back and they liked it, and they sort of put a whole lot of lore behind it. So they were actually coming out with like an ERC-20 token. The unicorns would come out with an ERC-20 token called Unicorn Milk. And once they collected enough, they could sacrifice it for a chance of winning like a villain NFT. So they sort of put like couched it in terms of their game. The game that, our team worked on the smart contract. So we built it as a fully on-chain game. They built the client to it and so on. So they had a website where their players would go and do all of this stuff. Now, you know, I thought when we did this that, okay, this is going to fill in some space. Their community isn't going to freak out that their game doesn't launch on time. And maybe like 10% of their players are going to play this. And like, you know, it'll be decent. It was an experiment. I wasn't really expecting much from it. I don't think they were either, right? The game launched on January 28th, 2022. And I woke up on January 29th. And more than 90% of their NFTs were like, you know, locked into the game contract. Over the 2 months that it ran, the game ran for 2 months on chain. The peak value locked into the game contract was over $100 million in value. Like, you know, we had attacks, we successfully defended against those attacks. Like, you know, it was just like a crazy exciting time. And it was just beyond anything that I would have expected. Like, you know, on Christmas Day, 2021, like I just couldn't even have expected, like, you know, what this would look like. And it was something that, like, you know, I worked on it from our side. They had like two people working on it from their side. Like three of us just, like, you know, built this contract, built this app. We launched it. It was like maybe less than a week of work. And it was beyond our wildest dreams. Like, you know, what kind of an engagement it got and how powerful it was in terms of their economy. You know, this token that they released with it, the Unicorn Milk, the ERC-20 token, you can see there's like a sharp line, you know, while the game was ongoing, how much it was worth, and then how the price dropped after they turned it off, right? Like it was just so critical to their economy. It kept them going for a long time. It created so much excitement and hype around their project, and it actually created sustainable dynamics in the economy. So after that, you know, that was it. I was a convert. Like, I just understood the potential in having these on-chain games, these fully on-chain games. I still hadn't like sort of come around. I still hadn't like realized how important it was for them to be permissionless. It took like a few more game launches for me to understand the value of permissionlessness in the games. But that was what hooked me, and that's what sort of set me down the path to building these kinds of games on chain.
That's so cool. Can you help our audience understand what types of games Web3 can support? Because you're saying permissionless games, on chain games. Are there permission games in Web3? Are there off-chain games in Web3? What's kind of the archetypes that are available for, say, if I have, let's say someone is listening and they're like, "Oh, I would love to build a game." What are the types of games or archetypes of games someone could build on Web3?
That's actually a very good question. And there's a few axes, you know, in which we should classify them. So let's first talk about decentralization, right? So like, and let's assume that the game is going to be Web3. You could build a non-Web3 game, but then, you know, you're probably not listening to Block Talks, or you're not like, so for Web3 games, you know, you like, I think the simplest thing, and this is what you were talking about before, like, you know, like the play to earn games and stuff like that. Most people in the space call them Web 2.5 games, where like the games themselves don't really have much to do with the blockchain, but they have assets. They might have NFTs, like items, you know, ERC-1155 or ERC-20 tokens that represent game assets that you can buy on a market, and then you can import into the game and, like, you know, play with it. But they usually don't have very much like going on Web3 besides the assets. Okay, they do have an economy. I mean, you know, as soon as assets live on chain, you have an on-chain economy. So there's like a, there's some really interesting stuff going on over there with the economics. But fundamentally, it's just like a regular game in which you can just purchase assets on an open decentralized market, you know, like OpenSea or Uniswap or something like this, and you can bring it into the game. So that's sort of like the, you know, the sort of base version. CryptoKitties is really interesting. Most people don't really count CryptoKitties when they're analyzing something like this, but CryptoKitties was far ahead of its time. It's like a really interesting case, but let's sort of leave that on the side for a second. Then you have like games that are fully on-chain, right? So fully on-chain games, right now also autonomous worlds, like people talk about autonomous worlds a lot in the space. These are games in which all of the game state and the game logic is represented on chain as smart contracts, right? So there's no like proprietary servers that are hiding like game mechanics from you. Everything is represented on the blockchain with smart contracts. These games might not be permissionless, right? So you might still have all of the game state and the game logic represented on chain, but maybe you can only play the game if you have like a particular type of NFT, or maybe there's like, you know, some sort of an admin who has special privileges on the game contract. Maybe they can ban users or like, you know, do stuff like this. And then there's permissionless games, which is what we build, which is in which they're fully on chain, right? All of the game state and the game logic is represented on the blockchain, and nobody has any special privilege or any special authority when it comes to the game. For example, in the case of the games that we build, we don't even say that, you know, you need to play the games with our NFTs or something like that. We say, hey, as long as you have an NFT on the blockchain that the game is represented on, or as long as you have an account on the blockchain that the game is represented on, you can play with no constraints and with no limitations. That's the level of permissionlessness that we're going for. And, you know, Moonstream, even though we build the games, we don't have any special privilege. You know, we don't have a treasury address that makes a tax off of like the tokens that the game is involved in. These are games that should outlive like, you know, any corporation or any organization. They can live, they should be able to live as long as the blockchain that they're on lives. And that's what I call permissionless games, right?
Oh, the possibilities are endless. We're not seeing game being processed on chain yet, are we?
Oh, we are.
We are.
Yeah, like I mean, they don't look like, you know, the games that are running on chain, they don't look like modern Call of Duty or something like that. They're much simpler games just because of how much, you know, computation costs money, right? When you're doing it on the blockchain, storage costs money. So they're much simpler games than like, you know, your AAA, quadruple A, like, you know, first person shooter kind of titles. But there's like a growing community of people building games in which all of the processing happens on chain. It's a very exciting space.
It is. Let's talk about successes first. What were the most successful games that you guys supported through Moonstream, and why do you think that is? I mean, you talked about the unicorn game, but what are the other examples you can talk about, and why do you think they were successful in their own terms? It doesn't have to be all they're successful in, you know, Web3 terms, like in the team's terms, and how they are dealing with, you know, their own project. What were those, and why do you think they were successful?
So we have Crypto Unicorns, Champions Ascension, Influence.eth is sort of like a more recent one. We have a number of customers. I don't think we can say that any Web3 game besides Axie has been hugely successful at this point. You know, Axie is the only game where like the number of players is even comparable to like a non-Web3 game, to a successful non-Web3 game. For most successful Web3 games, you know, the number of daily active users is still like, you know, in the low thousands, right? That's not something that like any game developer would like, you know, write home about as like a huge success. But for Web3, you know, the problem is that the I'll tell you why I think those are successful. But first, let me tell you why the numbers are so low in Web3. It's because onboarding users onto Web3 is fundamentally very difficult, right? Let's say that you're making a mobile game, then, you know, your addressable market is pretty much everyone that has a cell phone, right? Everyone that has a modern cell phone, right? If you're building a Web3 game, then until very recently, your addressable market is people who are able to get money onto, you know, whatever L2 you're operating the game on, which is brutal. That's like, you know, not only do you need to like know what MetaMask is, but you need to be able to like, you know, get like, you have to do this whole thing of like, you know, going to an exchange, buying the tokens, like, you know, bridging them over to your L2. You have to do all of this stuff to even be able to like qualify to play the game. until very recently, you know, that was the case. And so that's really hard. And so I think that's sort of the biggest limiter to the success of these games. But I think the thing that makes these games successful, I mean, the more successful games that I've seen are the ones where, first of all, it's not just the economy. Like, people are actually thinking about gameplay. People are actually thinking about, like, you know, how to give players something interesting to do in the game. Not very many games do that, at least in 2021. Like, summer, it was so easy to just launch a token, like, publish a white paper, and then, like, you know, make a few million dollars that there wasn't much incentive to, like, follow through and actually build a good game. So we prefer to work generally with teams that do have that follow through, that show that they have that commitment to what they're building. Those are the most fruitful engagements for everyone involved. I don't want to have a customer that's just going to pull the rug and, like, you know, leave in a month, right? So, right.
Due diligence is critical, even for suppliers. That's absolutely true. Now, let's look to the opposite. What were the biggest lessons learned from all of this? I touched in one subject I want to drill into a little bit more later, which is UX and onboarding. But in terms of, you know, lessons learned in the current, you know, state of affairs, what do you think were, say, the top three lessons learned you guys had since launching back in 21?
I think the most important thing from running our own games and from supporting other games has been how important it is to sort of to stay consistent with your communications to your player community. You know, people in Web3, there's a lot of trust involved, right? Even though the whole thing is trustless, there's a lot of trust involved. People are not gonna stick with your project if they feel as if you're untrustworthy, or if they feel as if you're unreliable. And so communicating clearly with your community, with your player base, and remaining consistent with that communication over time, like, you know, not just changing your mind every week and changing your roadmap or something like that. That's incredibly important. I would say that the other thing is it's a space that really rewards moving fast. You know, being too cautious is something I was certainly, like, overly cautious in 2021 and 2022, to my regret. I mean, you know, we survived the bear market, but it was tough, right? I think moving fast, innovating, taking your chances, that's something that at least I learned to value a lot, like, you know, over the last, like, 2 years, 3 years, right? 2.5 years that we've been doing this. And then just, like, you know, your reputation counts for a lot. Like, you know, we've built a reputation in the space, and now sort of it's really paying off. And it seems sort of counterintuitive, right? But in Web3, rather than, like, you know, compared to Web2, reputation counts for a lot. And that's something that's very easy to sort of lose sight of, especially in a market like this, you know, where now there's just a lot of excitement and there's so many things happening. It feels like it's easy to just, you know, so you should move fast, but you should sort of move according to a code. It's good to have a code, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's try and talk a little bit about the UX bit, because you mentioned something that really caught my attention. You said, well, it was really hard to onboard players, and you use that in the past tense. So I want to double click on that. What were, in your opinion, the biggest advancements in onboarding in the last couple of years? Because I'm with you. I did try to play most Web2 games that crossed my way. They were really hard to get to, sometimes, you know, requiring a couple of wallets, bridges, like DeFi stuff. Like, how do you get a player to play a game if you have to do swaps? Like, this is financial stuff. Like, this is really hard to master. And you're now putting that in the process of getting people to get to your game. They don't even know if the game is fun, and you're costing them like $1,400, $1,500. That is not exactly attractive. So that was the state of affairs, say, 2 years ago. You've been in this for 2-3 years now. What were the advancements on that space?
I think the most hyped advancement is definitely EIP 4337, right? Account abstraction. I don't think it's been, like, adopted widely enough yet, although I see more and more projects actually adopting it. And, you know, for any on-chain interaction, just having the ability as a project which is trying to bootstrap a protocol or bootstrap an application and say, hey, you know, I'm going to cover the gas. And you don't have to worry. All you have to do is like sort of log in and sort of authorize me, you know, whatever that looks like, and I'm going to take care of the rest. That's a big deal. That's actually a huge deal. I think it's very important. And I also think like 4337 isn't like the long-term correct solution to this problem either, because you know, someone is paying for the gas, right? And you know, the purpose of 4337 is to provide a censorship resistant way to a censorship resistant abstraction mechanism. But censorship resistant com resistance comes at a cost, right? So basically, like, you know, right now what you're looking at is just forget about like what the players are paying. Like, you know, if someone is doing something inside a game economy, someone has to pay an infrastructure fee, right? To the validators and to the bundlers, like the 4337, like all of that infrastructure and the blockchain infrastructure. And right now you're looking at a 2 times to 4 times increase in cost if you know that money coming out of your game economy if you're using EIP 4337 account abstraction to like you know make to basically have your players do stuff on chain. So that's a lot of money, right? That's a lot of additional money coming out of your economy compared to just doing that with an externally owned account. And so I think the long-term correct solution is going to be more centralized. Like, you know, so we build permissionless games. That doesn't mean that all of our infrastructure needs to be decentralized, right? Like, let's say that I want to make my game successful. We have a baseball game coming out on March 15th, right? We built our own account abstraction system. It doesn't need to be censorship resistant. You know, so we run it ourselves, and we can actually reduce the cost. So we can reduce the amount of money that comes out of our game economy in order to like execute transactions on chain. And that's a big deal because all of our games are fully on-chain games. There's nothing that doesn't happen on chain, right? But we can sort of like develop economies of scale if we have a lot of players. We're actually spending less money to the protocol than we would be otherwise in order to do these things. And I think we're going to see more and more solutions like this where games and just decentralized applications in general, you know, they various parties involved in like involved in those protocols, they come up with their own solutions to like reducing the amount of money that their application economy loses to the blockchain infrastructure. That's just really important to do when you're running an economy because that's tax. It, basically, we need to reduce our taxes, right?
Now, you said something again that really caught my attention, and I love that we're having this conversation because it's forcing me to think in concepts applied to different ways that I haven't thought of. So thank you for that. You said it doesn't need to be censorship resistant, and that speaks to centralization as much as it speaks to sometimes freedom of speech, say, right? And deplatforming, which is our day and age kind of scare of, you know, highly successful corporate networks, just to use some terminology coined by Chris Dixon on his latest book. Corporate networks have been the plague of the you know, censorship, because they choose what gets and what doesn't get accepted, and they act on it. The ethos and the promise of Web3 is the decentralization, self-sovereignty, you know, openlessness and permissionlessness, and openness and permissionlessness. But as in everything in life, especially in Web3, there is dilemmas and there are trilemmas. And I think what you're implying by that, and I just wanted to kind of clarify, that the trade-offs are there. If you are willing to pay for absolute censorship resistance, it's possible. If you're willing to trade off cost for censorship resistance while still maintaining ownership of your assets, that also is possible. So there's a whole spectrum, and I love spectrum. There's a whole spectrum of things or combinations that will then create opportunities for builders, because they can build any combination. It might be the exact same game with different trade-offs, and that's gonna cater to a different audience. And there might be different games with different with the same trade-offs in terms of censorship and cost and accessibility and UX, which gives space to many more potentially successful models. Now, all this to say is, in what you've experienced so far, and because you raised this point, what are the models that have been more attractive, into what type of player?
I can tell you like what players don't care about. Most people who play these games don't care about decentralization very much, to be honest. A lot of them are viewing them, you know, in the previous market, in like, you know, let's say post 2000, post 2021, sort of during the bear market. The people who stuck around were people who had basically invested a serious amount of money into those games. And so that's really the way that they were thinking about things. And so what they were really like, their perspective was more, how do I like generate value? How do I like retain value in these assets, right? Decentralization never really entered the picture in that conversation. And the kind of player that we're hoping to attract into Web3, we're trying to attract like just regular users, right? People who might not even know much about crypto. Maybe they have some like, you know, Bitcoin on Coinbase or whatever, but they don't have like, you know, they don't have a hardware wallet. They don't even have a MetaMask or like, you know, something like that. Those are the kinds of people we're hoping to bring in. And they also don't care about decentralization. Not really, right? They don't care about censorship resistance. So the one thing like that most people should realize is that the majority of your users are not going to care. And I think 4337 account abstraction is actually amazing to me. I mean, it's like really technologically, like really on, it's brilliant, like the way that it works. So inspired by Flashbots, you know, it's just, it does everything really well. But a lot of projects are treating that as a way for them to just cover gas for their users, which I think completely misses the point of what it's about. So, you know, support for 4337 in wallets is not great right now. Once that's a lot better, you know, it should be the user's decision to opt into 4337, not like not a game developer's decision, right? It's not the protocol's decision, like that like, you know, this is for the that this is, you know, we're gonna support 4337 by default. It's just a smart contract account. If a user opts in, they can use that infrastructure. And if you build your game permissionlessly, like, you know, you're not stopping anyone from using that infrastructure. But if you need to bootstrap the game, why are you accepting like a fourfold increase in like the amount of infrastructure tax that you pay just to, you know, to sponsor gas when you can do it much more cheaply? So that's one thing, is that most users don't care, but you should build your applications in such a way that for the users who do care, they're not penalized for like, you know, making use of that infrastructure. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, it should be easy. Like users will change over time. You know, even users who don't care today, they might care tomorrow. And it's important to give them an off-ramp. Like, you know, let's say that you're running a managed account right now, like, you know, an account abstraction, more centralized account abstraction system right now. You should give them an off-ramp where, like, you know, once they start caring a little bit more, once their assets start gaining value and they're like, hey, I don't want to leave like all of my important assets inside this account abstraction system that isn't censorship resistance, that, you know, this company does have control over, they should have an open and permissionless off-ramp to get their assets off. I think that's very important. And then just one thing about censorship resistance is, you know, there's you can get censorship resistance in multiple ways, right? And again, with different trade-offs. Again, there's a spectrum. You can bake censorship resistance into the protocol. Even EIP 4337 chose not to do that, right? They chose to have like this sort of parallel system that lives on nodes that opt into it that provide the censorship resistance. But the other way to get censorship resistance, and this is an old one, this is like, you know, like Adam Smith understood this maybe, is just by having a free market, right? By having like enough competition where like if somebody doesn't like, you know, one particular account system, it like, you know, this is the important thing about permissionless games. It requires a little bit of change in thinking is, you know, here's the game. Here's Moonstream providing a bunch of services that you use to access the game. But if there's a free market and if there are other people providing the same services, then you don't have to use this. You know, you can get censorship resistance to some extent just by having a lot of different options to choose from. And that's sort of my preference when it comes to running a game. It's really important to sort of recognize that. It's, you know, if you design a protocol so that it has a lot of constraints on it, it's very unlikely that you've chosen the right constraints. So in general, I try to like minimize the number of constraints that I place on the protocol. And it's okay to have like sort of decentralized pieces as long as, you know, they don't have a preferred status relative to the protocol, as long as anybody else could come in and compete with me. I want that to happen. If because if that happens, then like I know that my core protocol has been successful. And that's exciting to me, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the beauty of the composability as well, right? As we have it in the industry. Now, thinking about, you know, what people should pay attention to and what trends are emerging in the gaming space in Web3, what is it that you're seeing? Because I was just in Denver for ETH Denver, and there was a whole arcade.
I was there too.
Oh, we missed each other by a bit.
Yeah.
There was a whole arcade area only with Web3. I was blown away. I mean, they were really great looking games. And there were booths for gaming companies and all that. So that struck me as something that is kind of as we were like, oh, the ETFs are kind of the coming of age of crypto and financial services. Games might be just here to stay. So what is it that we need to pay attention to in, right now and what's coming, upon us?
That's a very good question. I think it's a very it's I certainly find it a difficult question to answer because I don't think anyone has figured out like what's going to bring regular users what's going to appeal to regular users, right? It's really not clear to me, and there are a lot of different bets being made. It just different directional bets being made. The big things that are happening right now is sort of like the AAA, like the AAA Web3 games like Shrapnel, I think Dead Drop, right? Like, these kinds of games that have launched or in the process of launching. They're in like their early stages of launch. I think what was is it Parallels? There's all that's a TC trading card game. That's sort of like one direction of bets is like let's produce like AAA looking games. Let's enable them with Web3 in certain ways, right? Either like at the most basic level, assets are on chain, you can buy them, and sort of they give you a boost in the game. Or with Shrapnel, they're even they're banking on user generated content, where you can create maps and then you get money, you earn money based on like how much your maps were played, stuff like that. So that's sort of one direction. I think Shrapnel is like more interesting than the others because they're trying to do this thing of like sharing revenue with content creators. I think that like that's something that even the like Epic who build who the Fortnite the people who build Fortnite, they're trying to do as well. They're trying to incentivize people to create content for their games. Roblox became really big on the back of this. Minecraft became really big on the back of this. So I think that's a very exciting direction, and that's something that Web3 enables more than any other platform, right? Roblox can take, I think their commission on like whatever revenue you earn is greater than 50%, like less well on certain platforms. So I think on iOS they take more than 50% of like what your creations make via Roblox. With Web3 Web3 has the potential to really challenge that, where like nobody actually owns the means of distribution, right? You might have preferred access to the audience, like if you build, sure, there's people who created Shrapnel, they have preferred access to their player base, but ultimately they don't actually control the channel of communication, right? Like if the maps are published on the blockchain, they can't stop you from publishing a map or something like that. So that's really exciting. In gaming, they call it UGC, user generated content. I think that's like a very interesting direction. So if you're of the mind of like creating content for games, or if you like to mod games, I think Web3 games are really exciting for that. And then on the other side, there's this huge like latent potential in the space of fully on-chain games. There's not much money in the space yet. There are a few projects that have attracted like a lot of VC money, tens of millions of dollars, but most of the projects are like not very well funded. But you have people who are actually trying to build like really cool stuff, and it's sort of on the cutting edge of like how cryptography is being used in games, and what's even possible to do on chain. So that's a very interesting space as well. Right now, it's more for like the nerds and like the builders, but hopefully like soon we'll have games that are coming out of this that are being built fully on chain that are appealing to regular gamers. Those are sort of like the two ends of the spectrum, and it's kind of polarized. Most games like fall firmly in this end or fall firmly in this end. But I think everybody who's building games that involve Web3 sort of universally understands the potential of just making people who are creating content for your games, like modding your games or stuff like this, just giving them sort of an equitable upside for doing so. So until now, people have not really had equitable upside, right? Like they like the you know I do you play what kind of games do you play, Mauricio?
The last one that I actually went the distance was Red Dead Redemption 2 a couple years ago. Yeah, I don't think I've played seriously any games after that.
I mean that's a great game. So that's good. I understand. So you like those sort of single player like RPG adventure games.
Well, I'm lying. I play solitaire all the time on the phone.
That's a fantastic game.
Like I'm a nerd for that, and I love cards, and it's been a while. My favorite game on my like young adult life was Magic the Gathering, the cards game. It's been quite a few years that I haven't touched that. But those were like, this is kind of where
Well, that makes its imprint on you.
very different like games in and on themselves. On the video game space, I was always a big fan of adventure RPGs like Zelda and all of the series. So I think those were mine. But this is not an interview about my gaming preferences. But yeah, this is where I had it.
No, I was just curious. Like, Magic the Gathering is a really good one. Is a really good one that I can use as an example. And a lot of people play Magic, so it's an easy one. Right now, Wizards of the Coast has full control over what Magic cards are published, what Magic cards are used in tournaments and stuff like that. But sort of the way that Web3 can change the game, and the people who are building Web3 games, I think universally realize this, is you can allow, in analogy, what would it look like in Magic the Gathering? You could actually have players propose cards, right? Propose new cards, propose new sets, new decks, right? That could go into Magic the Gathering. And if you're a company, let's say that you're running Magic the Gathering, and you make it equitable, where people actually see upside from successful proposals, now all of a sudden, you can create, I don't know, 1,000 times as much content as you were creating previously, right? Like you can make Magic like that much more engaging, but it does require you to create a system which allows you to test the balance of the game, that no card is going to be game breaking or extremely beneficial to the person who proposed it or something like that. So it comes with like a huge extra burden and a huge extra responsibility, but the benefit to your player base is insane, because now they have just so much more content available to them, like different types of tournaments, different game modes, and it's no longer just your responsibility as the person who created the game is just making sure that there's a system in place, a protocol in place where like the game can be balanced and fair, but it's no longer necessarily your job to create the content. And I think that's a really different way of thinking about games, and that's something that Web3 uniquely makes possible.
I love that. Man, we're approaching the end of our slot, and I could go on this because it's so entertaining. Thank you. A couple of things that I kind of balanced out of my guess, so I want to pick your brain on this as well, which is, what is the one thing that if we don't fix right now, we're going to work yet another 20 years in this industry, and we're going to look in hindsight like, we forgot this. It's broken everything. We're back where we started. What is the one thing and why?
Oh, I mean, we're sort of solving our onboarding problems, so I'm not worried about that. The biggest thing that I'm worried about right now is that the people making regulation don't understand, how they're stifling the creativity and the potential of this space. And I think like we really need to fix that collectively, globally, not just in the US, but globally right now. Because like a bunch of politicians who don't get technology are just determining what we can or cannot do with technology that they don't understand. I think that's a huge problem. A huge problem.
I like that. Yeah, regulation is definitely one of those. And in terms of like people coming into the space now, let's say I'm in the gaming industry and I've had all sorts of prejudice towards Web3, but now it's maybe the bull market. Maybe I should pay attention to this. What are the things you would recommend them to read, listen to, watch? What's the basic kit for getting someone that is interested in learning more about Web3 and more specific gaming?
That's actually a good question. I think it's too early to tell in this market cycle, because we're just going to see like completely different breeds of games than we saw before, which are not going to appeal to the same groups of people necessarily. I think the most important thing is, if you're someone who's sort of wants to get into Web3 and wants to get into gaming, just choose a chain, like choose a stack, like maybe it's Ethereum, maybe it's Solana, maybe it's Bitcoin, like just choose one and make sure that you can protect yourself. It's imp like you know it's important not to just trust like the ETFs or the exchanges with your money. Of course you should like go there, go there in order to like to get started, but at some point you want to take custody of what you own, and time that you spend educating yourself of how to like responsibly maintain custody of your assets will never be a waste of it. Like it'll never be wasted. It's always a really good thing to do. Just make sure that you educate yourself and sort of value self-custody, value self-sovereignty. I think that's incredibly important. I mean, you know, it never feels important until it is, and usually then it's too late. I think that's a really good thing to invest in upfront.
Yeah, I love that. Listen, thank you so much. I think this was one of the best catch-ups in gaming I've had in a long time. And I appreciate you taking the time. How can people find more about you, about Moonstream, about what you guys are up to? What's the way for people to get, you know, close to what you guys are building?
I think the best thing is just to go to our website. It's Moonstream, MoonStream dot to. Okay, so to the moon, Moonstream. And you know, if you're building things or if you just want to like figure out how some of this technology works, almost everything that we do is open source. So we do all of our work in the almost all of our work in the open. The stuff that's not in the open, it's purely for security reasons. But you know, we do almost all of our work in the open. And we're always happy to talk. So for people who are building things, you know, you can check that out. But just go to our website, moonstream.to, and that'll take you anywhere you need to go.
Awesome. Niraj, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate you sharing so much of your journey and your insights. It was really entertaining, really educational. And maybe see you next time. Thanks.
Thanks. Thanks, Mauricio. I really enjoyed the conversation. Yeah. Thank you.
Catch us online. We're on Instagram at Block Drops Podcast, on Twitter at Block Drops Pod or Xerox Mauricio. We're on Lens at blockdrops.lens. We have a newsletter on LinkedIn. Write to us at blockdropspodcast@gmail.com. And you can listen to the Block Drops Podcast at Spotify, iColab, Fabricum Tech, and all of the other major streaming platforms. Shout out to Niraj for sharing this new angle on Web3 gaming, permissionlessness in gaming in Web3. So interesting. And also to Martina Sardarian, who made this connection possible. Don't forget to leave your ratings on your favorite player. This is all for today. Stay rare, stay weird. LFJ.